Welcome to the Practical Employment Law Podcast, a podcast covering all aspects of American employment law. I'm your host, Mark Chumley. This may be hard to believe, but like every other subspecialty, labor and employment law has its fair share of newsletters. In fact, you can get the latest labor and employment law news on a daily basis if you're so inclined. Most people are not, but I do look at the daily news on a pretty regular basis. And one thing that always strikes me is that similar issues come up again and again, and they're often the same issues that I get the most questions about in practice. I'm going to start a new feature in the podcast of doing periodic updates on labor and employment law. I'll cover the latest developments, but as with all things in this podcast, we will focus on practical aspects and how to avoid problems. Now, these updates will all be based on recent cases that have been decided, but don't worry, I'm not going to bore you with legal minutiae. We will concern ourselves mostly with fact patterns. The first story I want to consider comes from Texas. It is Wesley versus Experian Information Solutions, Inc., and it was decided in the employer's favor on February 26, 2021. This one is a claim for overtime for idle on-call time. The case was brought by IT employees who were required to take turns being on call to answer client questions outside of regular work hours. The employees claimed that they should be paid for all of the hours on call, and the employer only paid them for the time they actually spent answering questions. Obviously, if they had been paid for all those extra hours, they would have been entitled to a lot of overtime. The employees claimed that they were restricted from certain activities, like having beers with friends or going on long bike rides, but they were able to generally use their on-call time for their own activities. The court ruled that while the employees may not have been able to partake in certain activities due to the nature of their on-call work, the employer was not required to allow them substantially the same flexibility or freedom that they would have if they were not on call, and being on call did not make their personal pursuits so difficult to accomplish that their idle time constituted compensable work under the FLSA. This is a classic on-call scenario that comes up quite often in wage and hour litigation. The question is whether the employee is waiting to be engaged, which is not compensable work time, or engaged to be waiting, which is work time. The real issue is what restrictions the employer places on the on-call time. The more restrictive the employer is, the more likely the time is compensable. In our Texas case, the employer required that on-call employees remain in compliance with the company's drug-free workplace policy and stay in an area where messages and calls could be received. That is pretty minimal, and as a result, the time was not compensable. If you have on-call employees, consider what restrictions you are placing on their on-call time. The more restrictive the employer is, the more likely the time is compensable. Many employers place a geographic restriction on on-call employees. This is not necessarily a problem, but the smaller the restricted area and the greater restricted conduct there is, the more likely there is an issue. Also, requiring an employee to remain on the employer's premises while on call is almost certainly going to result in compensable time. Moving on, the next case I want to consider comes from New Jersey. The case is Goldfarb versus Salomini, decided on February 18th of this year. This one involves another classic fact pattern, the rescinded job offer. In this case, the plaintiff, Goldfarb, quit his six-figure job on the oral promise of Salomini to employ him. Goldfarb asked for a term sheet, but was not given anything in writing. He was assured that he would be employed. However, the job offer was ultimately rescinded after Goldfarb had quit his high-paying job, and he brought a lawsuit. I know what you're thinking. He didn't have a contract, and he was an at-will employee, so he has nothing. Well, not so fast. There is another theory that the court applied called promissory estoppel. It comes into play when someone reasonably relies on a promise made by another and is damaged by that reliance when the promise is broken. It is a theory that is recognized in some form in most every state. I won't bore you with the details because there is a larger issue here. This case could have been easily avoided in a couple of ways. First, the glaring problem in this case is the lack of a written offer or agreement. I don't believe that an offer letter and agreement is necessary for every single employee you might hire, But for key, highly compensated employees, it is a must. If a proper hiring process had been followed in this case, it likely would not have ended in litigation. But here's another thought. There are all sorts of legal theories out there, and judges and lawyers can always come up with clever ways to use them. One way to motivate them to do that, to your detriment, is to act in a malicious or careless fashion and harm others by your conduct. Simply put, poor Mr. Goldfarb was treated in an unprofessional manner to great financial detriment. That is the kind of thing that will motivate a judge or jury to even the score. So the takeaways? One of my classic rules of employment law, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. And another classic rule, be nice or pay the price. My next case comes from Massachusetts and involves reasonable accommodation. The case is Daniel v. Walmart, and it was decided on February 18. The employee in question in that case was a training coordinator who was diagnosed with cancer. In 2015, she started a 10-year course of drug treatment that she claimed left her fatigued and unable to work nights and weekends. In 2018, the store where she was employed started hiring more part-time help, many on nights and weekend shifts. The employee was told that she would have to work one night and one weekend shift per week, and when she complained, she was told that her hours were, quote, set in stone. She was later terminated for several performance issues involving coworkers and customers. She sued and, among other claims, alleged a failure to accommodate. The court rejected this claim for a few reasons, but one of the most important was that she never actually requested an accommodation. She claimed that her supervisors were aware of her need for accommodation, and one even suggested that she apply for other jobs that did not require night or weekend hours. However, the court noted that the employee, as a training coordinator, was well aware of the proper procedure to request an accommodation, and the fact that her immediate supervisors did not have authority to grant her accommodation was also known to her. In addition, there was evidence that the evening and weekend shifts were essential to her position. Based on all of that, the court ruled in Walmart's favor. So what are the takeaways here? Well, this is something of a unique case because of the employee's position and knowledge of the accommodation process. Had this been a rank-and-file employee with most employers who had no special knowledge of the accommodation process, it might have come out different. Employees can be required to use a specific process to request an accommodation, but managers should be trained to refer them to this process when the need arises, even if the employee doesn't specifically request an accommodation. Now let's look at another disability case with a different outcome, this time from Arkansas. Decided on February 23rd, we have Baltz versus Ledestre Foods. In this case, the plaintiff was a national account sales manager who was terminated after requesting an accommodation for irritable bowel syndrome. In 2018, the employee received a good review and a performance bonus. Around the same time, she was hospitalized for her condition and had surgery. Managers exchanged emails around this time about the employee's pattern of being a victim and discussing plans to replace her. When she was out of the hospital, the employee requested accommodations for long-distance travel, but was presented with a performance plan and told she would have to sign it before accommodations could be discussed. She was given a deadline by which to return the accommodation paperwork, but was terminated before the deadline. Now, this was an easy case for the court to decide against the employer. Everything about it looks wrong, and obviously, this is not the way to handle an employee with medical issues. I really want to make just one key point here, emails. As with too many cases, the emails were deadly in this one. It continues to amaze me how many inappropriate comments continue to pop up in emails in litigation. Remember, email is forever in most cases, and it will always be requested in employment litigation today. In this case, managers as much as admitted to discrimination through their email conversations. If you're discussing HR issues in email, be very careful what you say and how you say it. No joking around. It never sounds funny in litigation. Also, consider simply refraining from discussion of HR issues via email and have in-person conversations instead. Now, I'm not suggesting that managers should cover up discriminatory motives. Obviously follow the law. But even in cases where there is no discriminatory intent, a stray remark or poorly worded email can be damaging in litigation. Finally, let's check in on the state legislature in Connecticut. The governor is expected to sign House Bill 6515 this week, which will take effect upon signing. The Connecticut legislature approved this legislation to amend the state's human rights law to prohibit workplace discrimination based on ethnic hairstyles. House Bill 6515 would amend the law to clarify that discrimination based on race would include ethnic traits historically associated with race, including hair texture and protective hairstyles. Protective hairstyles is defined to include, but is not limited to, wigs, head wraps, and hairstyles such as individual braids, cornrows, twists, bantu knots, afros, and afro puffs. The law is known as the Crown, C-R-O-W-N, Act, which stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. And Connecticut is by no means an outlier in passing this law. Laws under the same name have been in the news a lot lately. In 2019, three states, California, New York, and New Jersey, enacted legislation to protect individuals from race-based hair discrimination in the workplace, at school, and in other contexts. In 2020, no less than 23 states considered such laws, and Maryland, Colorado, Washington, and Virginia have passed crown laws. Also in 2020, the United States House of Representatives passed a crown law, but it was not passed by the Senate, and several municipalities passed crown laws, including Cincinnati, Ohio, where I practice law. The takeaway for employers, whether or not you're in a state or municipality with a Crown Act, is that any adverse action or harassment based on ethnic hairstyles will likely be viewed by courts and agencies as a proxy for race, and in states with Crown Acts, such conduct is expressly prohibited. If this is a potential issue in your workplace, you need to consider your approach sooner rather than later. A couple of thoughts on how to do that. Take a look at your grooming policy and make sure that it is in compliance with Crown laws. Also, ensure that human resources personnel and managers know about these issues. This has been the Practical Employment Law Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please watch for future episodes wherever you get podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you would like to contact me about any aspect of the podcast, my email address is mchumley@kmklaw.com, and my full contact information is in the show notes. This podcast was created for general informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice or a solicitation to provide legal services. Although we attempt to ensure that the podcast is complete, accurate, and up to date, we assume no responsibility for its completeness, accuracy, or timeliness. The information in this podcast is not intended to create, and listening to it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Listeners should not act upon this information without seeking professional legal counsel.